In the 10 years or so that Blackburn Study Center has been in operation, we've received help from a lot of different people, and no more so than from the folks at Veritas Academy and Veritas Press, Marlon and Lori Detweiler, and Ty Fisher, our first speaker. They've given us ideas and encouragement, curriculum, written materials for our organization. They've been very helpful. I think never have turned us down when we've asked them, any of them, to speak at this conference. And Ty is the headmaster at Veritas Academy, has been since 1997. He's a graduate of Grove City College and Reformed Theological Seminary. Ty's a permanent member of the Board of Governors of the Association of Classical Christian Schools, ACCS. He's the managing editor of the Omnibus Curriculum Project. All three volumes of the Omnibus books are upstairs at the Veritas Press table. With his lovely wife, Emily, who couldn't be here today, wrote the Veritas Press Bible curriculum. And the Fishers live in Lancaster County with their four girls. Ty has been a workshop speaker at this conference. I looked back to see when most recently, and I think it was clear back in 02 or 03. It was longer than I thought it had been. So we're pleased and honored that he could return as a keynote speaker this year. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. I have a couple of questions before we get started. How many ninth graders do we have in the audience today? I always watch out for them. Okay, one. Okay, you look trustworthy. How many Presbyterians do we have out there today? Okay, this first part, I'm just going to warn you, this first part's going to be tough for you, okay? But I'm one of your brothers, and I know it's tough. It's early in the morning. Note that I won't make you stand. I won't make you raise your arms, because at our church, we sing the Lord's Prayer every week. But we're Presbyterian, and our pastor says that we should raise our hands, but we can only get them up to here. Okay? But I want to warm things up here. It might seem early in the morning, but note that in Lancaster County, it's almost lunchtime now. We've milked the cows, and we had breakfast at 4, so we're looking forward to lunch. So here's your part in this first part. I'm going to say this phrase: friends, it's tough out there. And you're going to say, how tough is it? Now, we're going to practice a couple of times before we officially start. My GPS betrayed me this morning. Your roads, I thought the Amish were a traveling obstacle. Welcome to Pittsburgh, the world of infinite U-turns. Okay? Well, things are tough out there. Okay, now, listen, that's pretty good. That's better than I thought you would do. Even, you know, we do have a ninth grader here, and they always kind of clam up. Things are tough out there. They are really tough. They are so tough that a young kid with a paper route who was saving up money since last summer just purchased California, lock, stock, and barrel. Friends, things are tough out there. I'm glad you asked. I saw a possum this morning with a box and a sign next to him that said, waiting on the stimulus. Things are tough out there, friends. The Office Max is out of pink paper. That's how tough things are out there. Okay? Things are really tough out there. I saw a Pittsburgh Steeler cry. Okay, it might have been tears of joy, given. But, I mean, they don't usually cry, do they? Friends, things are tough out there. They're even getting down to Veritas Academy in Lancaster County, where the economy is so diverse that we never feel things like this. Let me give you two examples. The kids now are reusing spitballs and notes that they pass. They're erasing and reusing. Things are really tough out there. I just saw a paper published the employment rate instead of the unemployment rate. Okay, let me just tell you, maybe things are not as bad as I make them out. I took this assignment before I realized what date I would be speaking. We have this saying in my household. I've been the headmaster now for 12 years at Veritas Academy. And my wife has this phrase that we learned through painful experience called, "It's February." Okay? It's February. I hate February. I would cut it out of the calendar and add its little number of days to other months if I could. It's a depressing month. It's so depressing that we put in holidays about hearts and cards and romance. Okay, don't buy that stuff. It's just to get you through February. It's a cruel trick. The snow that was a beautiful blanket of blissful happiness a couple of months ago is now irksome. It's hurtful. It tells you, it testifies over and over that spring is not coming. It's a tough month at school as well. It's our re-enrollment month. And I made light of it being a tough time right now. But I want you to know that I don't want to make light of real experiences that you're probably having. I'm in them too. Our school has grown every year since its inception. We grow just a little bit, mainly providentially. We didn't actually start marketing the school until a couple of years ago, because we thought that might be devilish. And maybe it was, but more people tend to show up at your school if they know you exist. But this month is our re-enrollment month. So I'm sitting on pins and needles because I really don't know what will happen 2 weeks from now. I know that we will lose some students that are very happy being at our school because their families are taking economic hits. Problems are real. And it's also, even in good months, February is that time when people with a problem can't hold it inside anymore. Lancastrians never talk about their problems. This is how bad it is in Lancaster County. I hear about surgeries in my family 2 months after they happen because you can't admit that you have a problem. In February, I live like a vampire, never being hit by the light of the sun. I show up in the morning before the sun comes up at school, and I go home after it comes down. Fluorescent light is not sufficient. Okay? I have too many meetings in February. Finance committee meetings, ACCS board meetings. Okay, that was in Phoenix. That's not really fair. But too many meetings. I hope your February is not like mine, but I fear that for many of us, it's that time of the year of the long march of the third quarter. That long march where we ignore all of the holidays that the public school takes. Okay, so their kids are off and it's President's Day or, you know, Columbus Day. No one likes Columbus. But they get the day off from school. We'll be off earlier in the summer, and then I will sit at the end of my driveway and laugh at the bus as it goes by. Okay, but you might note that if you look at your outline, the title says something about refreshment. And by this point, you're starting to capitalize that. Refreshment. Refreshment, you said. And now you say, maybe he's lying. Refreshment in February? Well, I did see something refreshing lately, really refreshing. And I'll mention it now, and then I'll come back to it later. I saw a strangely dressed man making fun of someone powerful. Okay? That's fun. It happens at our Madrigal Feast dinner that we have at Veritas Academy around Valentine's Day. And the guy that leads us through the Valentine's Feast is our 10th grade student, Stephen Jacobowitz. Stephen Jacobowitz, dressed in orange and orange and yellow, dancing around, telling us all the stuff about the king sitting up there. It is fun to watch the jester make fun of the king. Now, that won't make any sense right now. Doesn't really. Maybe it's refreshing to you to think about that. By the time we get to the end, I hope I can make a decent point out of it. Today, I'm going to talk to you about something that I've found to be refreshing. I'm going to talk to you really in two parts. But those two parts are going to follow kind of biblical numbers, okay? We're going to talk about three truths, and we're going to talk about seven implications. Now, I could have talked about four truths and eight implications, but darn it, that just wouldn't feel as good, would it? Okay, these three truths are mainly ones that I hope that you've heard before, but they're ones this year that I've been forced to contemplate. Maybe not forced to contemplate, but blessed to contemplate. And I hope that as we contemplate them together, we will find blessing. So it's going to follow this pattern. I'm going to tell you some truths, and then I'm going to tell you practically what those truths have meant in my life and what they might mean for you. Here's the first truth, and I think yours have blanks in them. I have the answers right up here. The first truth is God is a Trinity. Okay? God is a Trinity, not a monolithic unity. I'll say it again because I hate when I don't get my blanks filled in. God is a Trinity, not a monolithic unity. Hopefully your first response to this, if you've read things like the Westminster Confession, you Presbyterians, or just creedal statements from the ancient church, hopefully your first response is something like, duh. I'm pretty sure that we don't think about this nearly enough. What if God were some monolithic unity? Okay? If he was, then our religion would be something like Islam. In the end, cultures with monolithic Unitarian gods end up being captivated by power. They end up being captivated by power. They are always grasping cultures that see weakness. Whenever they see or feel weakness, they immediately connect it to shame. Most of the problems that we have geopolitically as a nation now, pardon my analysis, but they really come out of that fact that some of our enemies have a Unitarian God, okay, and they grasp for power in any way that they can. Let me just tell you a little bit about the importance of the Trinity. It's kind of one of those doctrines that we don't think about a lot, mainly because it's hard to think about. Every analogy that we use for the Trinity eventually ends in some kind of misunderstanding, I think. But people died for this doctrine. And I'll tell you one little interesting story. Some of you might know it. Back in the year 325 AD, the Council of Nicaea came together to really deal with some Christological issues. And they produced that great creed, the Nicene Creed. And the main reason for the Nicene Creed, if we just want to dig down in Omnibus 2 here, you can read about it. I wrote the chapter on the creeds. And the main reason for the Nicene Creed was this. Okay, we think of it as a neat thing to have in your worship service maybe, or to study or to read about. The main reason was to get the right people kicked out of the church. Okay, there were some heretics called Arians who were denying the divinity of Jesus Christ. And Athanasius, the great church father, was looking for language that they would not agree to say. So he would try out language. You know, it could be like a PowerPoint projector. And he'd put it up on the board there and everybody would look at it. And if the Arians would say, yeah, we buy that, he would go back to the drawing board, he would scribble it out, and he would say, what language can we use to get these guys kicked out of the church? Because they need to be out. They don't believe in the divinity of Jesus. That's back in the days when people thought things like that were important. Finally, they settled on this one word. And it's in the original version of the creed, it was the word homoousios. Okay? When we say it in English, it means, when we say the Son is, Christ is of one substance with the Father. Okay? And the Arians said, yeah, we don't believe that. We can't say it. So Athanasius said, that's the right language. Get out. they instead said, we would like to add one letter. One letter. One iota. One little I into the word homoiousios. Which if that would have passed the council, we would say that the Son is a similar substance with the Father. Not quite God, but pretty near, as they would say in the South. Okay? All of orthodoxy hung on that one iota. Athanasius went into exile 6 times for that one iota. This doctrine is very important. And it also points us toward the nature of the Trinity. Note this. The Trinity is eternal. It was not, the Trinity didn't happen at the incarnation. The Trinity didn't happen at creation. Throughout eternity, the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, have been there, not needing creation. Okay, they don't need it. I'll talk to you more in the rest of the talk about why they made creation. Also note this, that the nature of the Trinity, I recommend a Western view of the Trinity. And that's my view of the Trinity. I have a Western view of the Trinity, and you should too. If you are of Greek or Russian Orthodox persuasions, you should know that that what I'm telling you now, you'll have to look into and see if you buy it. If you do, come on over here. Okay? The difference between the two Trinitarian views is mainly summed up in this one phrase. It just gives you a hint. Most, you might think that anywhere you would go in the world, anywhere within Orthodox Christianity, where the Nicene Creed was said, that we would all say the same words, mainly translated into different languages, but that we would all say the same words. That is not quite true. There's one phrase that we say in the West that we added in without permission of the East. So they don't like that. And it comes in that part of the creed that says that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. In Latin, it's filioque, and the Son. In the Eastern Church, I remember listening to a lecture by a Russian Orthodox theologian, a scholar, and he was pointing out that economic, back when we believed in economics in this country, economic prosperity came to Trinitarian countries. And he was talking about how this Trinitarian countries believed in a shared view of power. And then I raised my hand afterward and I said, but in the Eastern view of the Trinity, it's kind of Father up here and Son and Holy Spirit kind of down below in a kind of subservient manner. In the Western Church, our view of the Trinity, and I think it's a biblical view of the Trinity, is that these Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are not grasping for power from each other. Okay, and this leads us to the second truth. The Trinity has always been about joyful, self-sacrificing love. The Trinity has always been about joyful, self-sacrificing love. God's a Trinity, and that Trinity has always been about joyful, self-sacrificing love. And let me just tell you this. This is something that just until recently, I don't think I wrapped my mind around. I always misunderstood this phrase. God made the world for His own glory. Okay? That's kind of at the root of things. I mean, when we start teaching at our school, we teach the kids the catechism, and because we really like the Westminster Shorter Catechism, that's the one that we use. And at that first question, you know, what's man's chief end? Man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. God's glory is tied up in man's purpose and in all of creation. And I want to tell you what our Trinitarian God is not like, okay? He is not out to dominate the world by crushing us down with His glory, okay? His purpose in the world He's not so glorious, or he's infinitely glorious, but the purpose of that glory is not to crush us down. His purpose is not to destroy creation or to destroy human nature. God's grace perfects nature. It lifts it up. God's grace makes us more human, not less. God doesn't mean to make us into ghosts someday, and I can prove it. I can prove it. He sent His own Son, and He didn't send Him to become a ghost. He didn't send Him to divorce Himself, to divorce the divine nature from humanity. He took the human nature of Jesus Christ, and today a man owns the universe. Dust from this earth rules over light years and light years from here. Human nature has been raised up, not crushed down and forgotten. There's a great scene from one of my favorite books, one of C.S. Lewis's favorite books too, his book, Till We Have Faces. And in Till We Have Faces, there's this, it's the retelling of the story of Psyche. And at the end, Psyche's sister, who's betrayed her, is fallen into this trance, and she sees this vision of God coming to her, and God's presence makes her beautiful. It turns her into something, the fulfillment of humanity. God is going to make you and me like Jesus Christ. We're going to become truly human. Second, and by this second point here, don't get nervous, Presbyterian friends, but God did not create the world to be some massively complex micromanager. God is not a control freak. Okay? This does not mean that he doesn't control everything. It doesn't mean that anything is outside of his control. We know that the hairs on our heads are numbered, and that no swallow falls to the ground without his knowledge. But his personality is not one that is denoted by things like micromanaging. Okay? Finally, God is not someone who wants to make us continual grovelers. Okay? We do grovel coming into his presence because we're sinners, but he means to make us sons. He constantly lifts us up. How many of you like Dickens? Any Dickens fans out there? I don't like Dickens. Okay? My wife likes Dickens. I don't like him, mainly because I think that he can say in 1,000 words what Austin can say in about 15. Okay? That's why his books are 900 pages long. And why at page 500 my wife starts to say, I'm really getting this now. Okay? But in one of Dickens' books, one of my favorite characters is Uriah Heep. Okay? Uriah Heep is that groveling, false humility kind of guy. Oh, I'm so humble. He's always a groveler. I hate Uriah Heep. When kids come to my office and they Uriah Heep it in a disciplinary situation, I'm like, grow up and take your punishment, okay? God called you to be a man, not to just kind of grovel here. It really aggravates me. God doesn't want this from us. He made us to be like Jesus Christ. Okay? We need to come to God with our sins. But remember, there is something radical about what Jesus said. His accusers got some things right. When he said, I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. They said the first thing that came to mind. Arrogant. You're arrogant, Jesus. Think about what he taught us to pray. Our Father. Now for us, those words slide off of our tongue. They slide off because we're so used to saying them. Right? What kind of radical our Father. And of course, if you dig in the Greek a little bit, 70s rock and roll, you know that the phrase he was using was Abba. Right? Abba. And Abba is untranslatable, really, in Northern English. But I spent some time in the South, and the exact translation is something like what a teenage Southern girl says to her father. It's the word diddy. Diddy. You know, it's extremely informal. Usually Presbyterians, when I translate biblical stuff, I always make it kind of higher and mightier. But it's daddy. Ah. This is what our Trinitarian God, that's what he's not like. He's not out there to dominate the world and crush it down and destroy nature and human nature. He's not a micromanager. He doesn't want to make us grovelers. This is what he's like. He is constantly looking out toward the other. The persons of the Trinity eternally looked in love toward each other. They take care of each other's needs. Their love is so great that it flows out into all of creation. They made creation not so that something could serve them, but so that they would have their love flowed out even in overabundance. That's the way our lives should be. Let me tell you a little story about my girls. My girls are my favorite people. They're some of the best people that I know. And they have... I'm not a great father for little itsy-bitsy kids. I can play with them. I can love them. My wife does a lot better with them. I like when they start to read things. That's kind of when I key in. Okay, and I really like to move their interests forward. My daughter Maddie, my oldest, she's a third grader. She's a cook. She loves to cook things. Okay, and she's good. She's good for Valentine's meal. She cooked grilled shrimp with citrus aioli. Okay, I can't even spell aioli. Okay, she did tenderloin tips with toast and chocolate creme brulee. That's my little third grade girl. She did that. Okay, now that's really cool. And Maddie loves to serve in that way. She doesn't always love to serve in every other way, but that way she really likes to. The story though is about my daughter Lane. Now, I'm a first child. I'm a first child, so I always knew that my job in my family was to keep order. And everybody else's job was to follow me. Okay, you might be a first child. But second children have this interesting position where they can either kind of be graspers, or they can be grovelers, or they can be followers. My daughter Lainey has this great ability. I think she reflects the Trinity very well. Maddie is a cook, but Maddie needs things. She needs affirmation for her cooking. Okay, so what Lane has done, and she did this unconsciously, I didn't tell her to do it, she's become the food critic of our family. So after every meal, she rates everything in the meal. Okay, especially things that her sister has cooked. And she does it kind of, her model for this is the character Ego in Ratatouille. Okay, so she's serious. I mean, she'll taste it and Maddie just watches her. And Lainey, she'll go, ooh, a little bit too spicy. A little bit too spicy, 94. And she gives her, like, true, real opinion. Okay, but then when she says 100, Maddie's heart just is jumping, okay? Because, but Lane has looked, and she's seen the need of the other, and she's reaching out in love. Note this. This is what God is like. The world and man were made because love poured out of the never-ending, bottomless well of divine love. The Trinitarian God keeps reaching out in love, and this is the glory of God. Not to crush the world down, but to raise it up. Not to crush you down, but to raise you up. And this leads to the third great truth. And that is that the Trinitarian God did not make the world to eat it. He did not make the world to eat it, but he gave himself to be our feast. Listen, some of you probably see some of the directions I will go in this little part here, but this is a radical statement in the ancient world. We don't catch the power of this. Because the gods of the ancient world were devourers. They ate their worshipers. You can check this out. Look back at the early stories of the Titans, of Cronus, Zeus's father. What does he always do? Every time a kid's born, he's hanging around to eat them. Okay? Not the best father. The gods of the Old Testament. Well, and Zeus, of course, follows suit, right? He's always a child-eating god. The gods of the ancient heathen nations, what did they do? They fed on their worshipers, particularly on their children. One of my professors at Grove City was a man named Dr. John Currid. He was also a professor of mine at Reformed Seminary. I think he's in Charlotte now. He did a great presentation once on a dig that he did at Carthage. And at Carthage, they found this place, ancient Carthage. They were digging. They found this place full of these beautiful vases. Okay? But I was like, wow, look at all this wonderful artwork. And all of the vases are filled with the bones of children. Okay? Sacrificed. It reminds us a little bit of our culture, sadly. The worst child-eating story is the story of the Feast of Thyestes. Okay, this is. I mean, if your stomach's weak, you should probably just plug your ears up now. I'll wave my hand when I'm done. The Feast of Thyestes. Thyestes is tricked into coming to a meal served by his enemy, and his enemy secretly kills his children, cooks them, and serves them to the father unbeknownst. The ancient world is a world of child and worshiper devourers. Okay? But this is not the way the world started. God made the world for man to eat. I was listening to a lecture by James Jordan recently, and he pointed out there were no... Adam was kind of, you know, tend the garden, but it wasn't tend like tend and farm. He had no need to farm the garden. God just was handing out food. It was a welfare system there in the garden. But it was a righteous one. A father was giving sustenance to his child. Okay? It was good. And it still is good, though cursed. Okay, so God, instead of eating worshipers, God in the beginning gave Adam food to eat. Without money. He gave him food to eat. But man fell. So at that point, we could say, maybe God will turn into a devourer now. Maybe he will turn out in the end to give man his just desserts. That's kind of a bad phrase to use, I guess. But he doesn't. He doesn't. Instead of devouring man, he sends Christ to be his feast. God serves man himself instead of devouring his worshipers. This is a mind-boggling paradox. It would not have been lost on you or me if we were worshipers taking communion in the first century. It wouldn't have been lost on us that the gods that the heathen nations served outside of our service were ones who were devouring their people. But our God serves himself to us. These are the three great truths to contemplate. And I feel like I could stop here. But what I'm going to tell you now is a couple of implications that this should have on your life. First implication. I break these up because I'm hideously have to categorize things. I break these up into general implications, family implications, and educational implications. Here's number one. Number one is this, that you are a child, and that is okay. Okay? I've experienced something. I hang around in classical education. I've hung around there for 12 years. This makes me have the second longest tenure at one school of any headmaster but one in the 220 schools in ACCS. That's kind of a fun statistic when you're 36, okay? Or 37. But this, there's what I call the destructive myth of competency, okay? If you hang around in classical education, you will meet people like this. Maybe you're like me. Maybe you are a person like this sometimes. And it is, you want to be so mature, and you have to have some kind of systemic, principled answer to all philosophical questions. You must know why you eat toast in the morning. You must know why it's classical to put on your right sock before your left sock. You must know exactly why this spelling thing that you use works better than the spelling thing that your neighbor uses that looks like the same thing. You must know that. I've seen people tremble. Seen them tremble because they have to have those answers. Listen to this. If you're doing classical education to one-up your family members or folks at your church or to feel good about yourself or how much you know, stop. Okay? Stop. It's too heavy a cross to bear. Okay? You missed the point somewhere along the line. Okay? You're a child. And that's okay. God didn't make you to be anything else. You have to be content with this truth. We don't have all of the answers. And we won't have all of the answers. Think about this for a while. Your human mind, I don't believe, can contain all of the answers. So you will have to be content for all of eternity, growing in wisdom and knowledge and never reaching the end. So you might as well just give in now. and be comfortable. I'm not slandering the pursuit of truth, and I'm not telling you not to strive. I'm just telling you that you live within limits, and not because you're sinful or evil or wrong or wicked. You live within limits because that's just the way God chose to make the world. It's the way He chose to make you. Here's the deeper and more refreshing truth that goes along with this first implication. We don't have to have all the answers, and it's just okay. I'm a fan of Dante. I'm a big fan of Dante. I read a different translation of the Comedy every year. Okay, and in Paradise, I've never really felt at home in Paradise till this last read. Maybe that tells you something about me. But in this last read, I really loved the third part of the Comedy, Paradise. And he talks all about Beatrice's eyes. So I went and I started reading stuff on the eyes of Beatrice. And what I realized is that Beatrice's eyes are always kind of sparkling and lively. And he talks all about her eyes. And then I realized why. As I was sitting across the table from my daughters, I've read about her sparkling eyes, and then I see one of my daughters talking and her eyes sparkling. Beatrice's eyes sparkle because they flicker with a simple trust. She is content, not because she knows everything in Paradise. She's content because she has a father who's taking care of her. And she can be content being who she is, not being discontent with where God has taken her. She has a trust that sometimes we lack. So you're just a child, and that's okay. Implication number one. Implication number two. Children should look like their parents. Children should look like their parents. Therefore, you should be a feast for others. Remember, there are problems. Questions will be asked if children do not look like their parents. Okay? Remember how the worshipers of idols sacrificed their children, how I talked about those vases at Carthage. All through the Old Testament, the Israelites are called a stiff-necked people. Does anybody know when the first time they were called a stiff-necked people was? It's funny. It was in Exodus 32. Exodus 32, when they build the god, the golden calf. Okay? I don't know about Pittsburgh. You have hills that cows cannot stand on here. Okay, in Lancaster County, we have more cows than people. Okay, at the school, I could look out the third grade or the first grade classroom and go, oh, look, cows. What do you note about cows? They are stiff-necked. Okay, they go around like this. God, people become like their gods. So when the Israelites made a stiff-necked God, they became a stiff-necked people. But remember, God became our feast, so we have to become like Him. We have to look like our daddy. That means you have to become a feast for your children. You have to become a feast for each other. This is especially important in a homeschool setting where it's tempting to make the world more and more narrow. You have to look for opportunities in your church, in your family, in your community to serve each other and become a feast for them. What is a feast like? Well, I'm trying to become an expert on feasts. The experimenting is good. Okay, we have a feast, a Sabbath feast, as my parents and grandparents did. We have Sabbath feast on Sunday afternoon. And my wife is a good cook, thus I need to go to the gym more often. But good feast gives its best. You put out your best food. You put out your best drink. It gives without consideration of 20 minutes after the feast. Because how do you feel 20... If you're a mom, how do you feel 20 minutes after the feast? Sometimes you feel... You know, sometimes it's a long, drawn-out thing. Maybe you feel happy at the end, but if it happens quickly, and with four girls, nine and under, sometimes they eat too quick. And then mommy goes, why did I do this? Okay? Feasting doesn't consider 20 minutes afterward, and it doesn't give careful contemplation or calculation of the future. If you want to learn about feasting, go out and rent my favorite foreign movie with, was it Dutch and French with English subtitles, named Babette's Feast. Okay? You should watch Babette's Feast. It's all about learning to enjoy feasting. It's really about more than that, but I won't give you any more hints, so you have to watch it. Implication number three. Life is an adventure. It's not a beat down. Life is an adventure. It's not a beat down. If you are a child and a feast for God and others, then what? Okay? Then life is an adventure. Bad times are an adventure. They're not, that doesn't mean that they're happy. It's just an adventure to see how God is going to provide. Suffering is not meaningless then, but we need only suffer what is real. Okay? So many times I find myself suffering with things that God hasn't put on my plate, but things I put on there myself. Okay? Suffer, really suffer. Okay? Suffer real things. Okay? Life is an adventure. God doesn't mean to make it a permanent, eternal beatdown. Okay? Those are the three general implications. Here are the family implications. First, implication number four. God gave you children first and foremost so that you could enjoy them. Okay? Now, I'm saying this, and I haven't heard too many other people say it, but I think I'm right, so I'm going to say it anyway. But, you know, check it off, other people. Here's my tendency. My tendency is to want to fix them, okay? Or to train them, or to guide them, or to you know, some Germanic Presbyterian task that I have in mind, okay? Because I want them to be uber-mensch-ish Nietzschean Christians, maybe, in the end, right? No. That's not why God gave you children. He gave you children first to enjoy them, okay? Here's an example in my family. My daughter, Lainey, loves bugs, okay? Not because of me. I hate bugs. I'm from the Midwest. Bugs are scary, okay? We don't have nice bugs out there. They're mean, they sting, they bite. You keep them out of the house. My daughter Lane has not learned this. She loves them. She jumps into big fruit trees full of them. She takes stings. We have this great picture of her with handfuls of Japanese beetles, smiling, just beaming. Her face is just stung everywhere. She doesn't care. She just loves bugs. She brought home a huge praying mantis in her pocket from school. And then Daddy said, "That's why God made the outside world, for bugs. This house is not for bugs." But you have to enter into and enjoy those things that your kids enjoy. Here's some practical help. Do this. Take a day off and find out what your child enjoys. And just do it with them. It's best to be a surprise, okay? It makes you seem really cool if you do it this way. Just take a day off and say, "Whatever you enjoy, we're going to do that today." And then later on, take some time, less than a day, and spend time with your child doing what you love and just enjoying doing it with them. If they say, "I don't want to do that," say, "We did what you enjoyed. Now you need to learn to love what I enjoy." The Trinitarian relationship does not look at others as a means to an end, but as an end in and of themselves. Okay? This building, we think of countries and buildings and forests as kind of eternal and immortal or long-lasting. The only thing that you've met that's eternal and immortal in physical bodies is the person that you hang around with all day long, every day. Every person that you've met will be around for eternity. Implication number five. If your children doesn't measure up to your standards, if your child or your children don't measure up to your standards, lower your standards. Okay? I'm going to say this again, because you might have misheard what I just said. The first time I heard it at an ACCS conference from Doug Wilson, I misunderstood it. If your children don't measure up to your standards, then lower your standards. Okay, I still argue with my friends sometimes about what that meant. But here's what I believe it is. I believe your first job as a parent or as a teacher is to reach out to the other in love. Okay, to be like the father of the prodigal son, which is kind of a picture of God if I read the text correctly, right? Not like the older brother. Okay? Does the son measure up to the does the prodigal son measure up to the standards of the father? I hope not. I hope he had higher standards than that. Does he just cut him off and throw him away forever? No. He does what God does. He reaches down. Christ did not set some standard and say, I will hang out with you when you reach this standard. He came down and took on human flesh, and he picked you up off the ground, and he means to raise you up to eternal glory. He came down. You should come down too. This does not mean that you should not have standards. It does not mean that you can bless sin. It does, however, mean that you can only accomplish so much from where you are and where you want to where you want to go. You cannot move things from here to there just because you want to move them from here to there with your child. You have to find how far you can take them and know that it might be the job of the next generation, if you can get your child to love these standards that you set, to move up another step. Okay? If your children don't measure up to your standards, then lower your standards. I'll tell you a scary story that I just heard from the guy who's going to be my grammar school principal. He went to a Christian school, and in that Christian school, they had 11 in his graduating class. He was in an environment where things, standards were really pressed down. It was a tight thing. Five of those kids kind of stayed in those standards. Five of those kids left the faith completely. And then there's him. Okay, this is kind of what Christianity is doing right now. We're batting, the Barna survey recently said, we're batting at about 4% for the next generation. Yikes. Okay? Two educational implications. First one, implication number six. You might as well enjoy the ride because I'm guessing you won't be buying slate. Okay, let me make sense of this strange statement. You might as well enjoy the ride because I'm guessing you won't be buying slate. One of my alumni is now at Princeton University. This gives me an excuse to go to Princeton and hang out. Okay? Because my Presbyterian forefathers sunk what turns out to be millions and millions of dollars into the ground there. And I get to hang around in those places. I saw something amazing on my last tour of Princeton. And it is this. I saw slate on a roof that is 1 3/8 thick. Okay, for some of you who don't have an understanding of architecture, this is slate this thick on the roof. Okay, that's really too far. 1 3/8. Okay, this building was built in 1880. We were there with a staff architect. 1880, he said, and we have the original roof. And then with a shrug, he said, "Our best guess estimate is that this roof has about 200 to 300 more years left." Whew! I want to build a roof with slate. I love slate. Okay, I want 2-inch slate. Make it for 800 years. But remember, that's not where God's called us right now. Remember also this, that children are generally more short-term thinkers than adults. Like short-term, like this afternoon. Okay? They don't love slate as much as you do, probably. Make sure that what you are doing fosters an attitude of love and joy. If not, then your kids are going to hop off the bus as soon as they can. If you ever see them counting down the days, minutes, or seconds till their 18th birthday, this is a bad sign. Okay? Note this. Don't ever listen to anything, well, maybe you listen to some things, that the postmodern critic Derrida said. But he did say this one wise thing. Play at it. Okay? Enjoy the ride on the bus. Final implication. Successful education occurs when the love of the Trinity infuses our knowledge and pours into and onto the next generation. Successful education occurs when the love of the Trinity infuses our knowledge and pours into and onto the next generation. We have tests in everything. But remember what the big tests are. The big tests are not your SAT scores or your Stanford tests or your logic finals. The big tests, Dante says, as he goes through paradise, are faith, hope, and love. Faith is exposed as true or false by whether it yields hope and love. Here are some tests that you should use to know if that love of the Trinity is flowing out. Your children should crave your presence. I watch this with my teachers. The kids at my school love to be with my teachers. They love to be with Mr. Dennis. They love to hang out with Mr. Walker. They want to do everything with them. Remember, the disciples in the Gospels crave Christ's presence. They want to be with him. Okay? Do your kids want to be with you? If not, you need to work. You need to work toward this kind of Trinitarian love pouring out because people are drawn to it. Next test, what do they do with their free time? Do they love the right things? Are they on the way to loving the right things? Don't give up hope, okay? Because ninth graders grow up. and maybe they already have. Ninth grade boys even grow up. Okay? Are they beginning? And then the last test I think you should use is this. Are your children beginning to pour out love on the people around them? Not perfectly. I mean, if you have more than one child, you look for those little places of love, you see love pouring out. Because in families, there's enough room for offense to be given. Okay? When you see those little bits of love starting to pour out, that's the love of the Trinity that's flowed down to you and your family and is flowing out of your children. And that's good. Okay, not everybody agrees with me on all of these things, but I say, give them time. They will come around. Now back to the jester. At the play, I realized this. It takes a Trinitarian culture to have jesters. Okay, we even have them now. I mean, it's even in secular America, they're stuck. Their names now are like Jay Leno and David Letterman and Conan O'Brien. But let's just be clear about this. Osama bin Laden has no jester in his cave. Okay? I mean, imagine this. Trinitarian cultures don't hold on to power like non-Trinitarian cultures. This is brought home to me, I think most poignantly, in, I believe it's Horse and His Boy, where the Narnian princes walk the streets of Calamine. And the Calamines they don't understand it. The Narnian princes walk around and they joke with each other and their heads aren't covered. The Calamine princes are always shrouded in mystery and everybody has to address them with all of these long things, long titles and such. Trinitarian cultures produce jesters. They don't take themselves as seriously or they don't hold on and crave power in the way that others do. I hope contemplating some of these truths and the implications will be a refreshment to you even here in February. Thank you very much.